Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One. This is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Gary Smith.
Welcome to what's becoming kind of our Sunday tradition here at the altar of Reasonable Doubt, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Gary Patrick Smith over there. I don't see your son running around, so it's a good morning for you.
Well, I can't run around either because I've locked myself in this room from the outside so that he can't come in and interrupt us. But he's around. He's around. He's testing things.
Have fun with him today. Where do you want to start? Probably the biggest week in Supreme Court history. So
I think I want to start with a tip of the cap to our assistant, our associate producer, Brett, who helps us out with stories. He's been swimming in it this week because, as you said, a few things have gone on. So he did a great job in breaking it down to help make me sound smart here, hopefully.
Yeah, there's been four decisions this week of real note. Obviously, the one invalidating Roe versus Wade and Casey, also the NRA case invalidating the New York state law on gun restrictions. Mm-hmm. Then there was a 1983 case that didn't get a whole lot of publicity. 1983 is the civil rights section of the federal code, which basically the U.S. Supreme Court now says that a Miranda violation no longer is actionable, meaning you can't sue. So if a cop doesn't give a proper Miranda and gets a false confession and convicts you illegally, unconstitutionally, even if you're innocent, you can't sue on the basis of a violation of Miranda. Welcome to America to 2022.
It's just absolutely crazy. I mean, that one involved a Los Angeles sheriff's deputy, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. It came out of the L.A. Superior Court. It was Vega versus, I think it's Tico.
Tico, yeah.
And I've been watching that case as it goes up there, never expecting that they were going to basically start the gutting of 1983, but clearly they have.
Well, I guess I'm obviously Roe is a big one. I'm also very interested in how the New York ruling is going to reverberate to places like California, because, you know, very similar restrictions at least were in place in California, you know, until that ruling came down.
Well, and by the way, I mean, I'm old enough to remember I often invoke my father. My father was a district attorney at the time that abortions were illegal in California. And I remember him getting women to, as a DA, getting them to roll over, so to speak, or turn state's evidence to convict the doctor on charges. So that's something that, at least in my lifetime, I remember. And whoever thought that we were going to return to that. One of the interesting things that I've thought about and has been covered just a wee bit, but if you read the decision, and then if you read Clarence Thomas's concurrence, mm-hmm. basically, which he wrote solo, nobody joined in with, he then questioned, which has long been his kind of, you know, people have characterized him as the kooky uncle at your Thanksgiving dinner, but I think that does him quite a disservice, because clearly his jurisprudence is what has led us to this decision. But he questioned Griswold, which is the
contraception,
part of the right of privacy. He questioned Obergefell, which is the same-sex marriage case. And what I don't know what he didn't cite, interestingly, is he's famously married to Ginny Thomas, who is a white woman. The Obergefell case and Griswold are part of a line of cases that include the Loving versus Virginia case. Loving was the case, I believe it was decided in the 60s, which invalidated a Virginia statute that made it illegal for a white woman or any races to marry one another. So blacks and white could not marry. In fact, Loving specifically was a black and a white marrying And they were sentenced to a year in jail, although the judge gave them the option of leaving the state of Virginia. And if they left the state of Virginia, he wouldn't impose the sentence. Now, that was a 9-0 decision invalidating that law. But if Thomas's logical legal premise is correct, then he would, by eliminating these cases of substantive due process, he would eliminate the underpinnings of Loving. And depending if those laws were still on the books or if he resides or is in a jurisdiction, there is no right to marry under his theory of his textualist theory and eliminating substantive due process. And he could become a felon and be sentenced to prison based on his marriage. And it's interesting that he invokes the same-sex marriage, but I didn't see anywhere in the opinion, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, where he assiduously avoids mentioning Loving, which I think is a tell, if you will, on whether or not this is, driven by something other than a concern for the Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you see the New York ruling reverberating out across other jurisdictions? I mean, do you see that bringing substantive change to places like California that are similar to New York in their restrictions on concealed carry distribution?
I think already you're going to see within the next week, California is trying to take some preemptive action, but it's a real problem. There was a case out of San Diego where a federal district court judge had pretty much presaged this. And the Ninth Circuit, at least in the reversal, I think they're going to have to go revisit it immediately because their reversal of the district court judge in San Diego who had enjoined these things is now going to be invalidated. So the U.S. Supreme Court is remaking society. And it's somewhat ironic when people talk about activist judges. For somebody who's been in the law for 40 years, it does kind of substantiate what I've always said. You know how I always say a jury trial is determined in jury selection? Well, the corollary to that is your case is determined by what judge you get. And that's the Supreme Court has now made it quite clear that it's a roll of the dice, depending on what your issue is, what their agenda is, and that's the way they're going to go. So right. Exposed a political kind of dirty secret, if you will. And I think that one of the ramifications is going to be is that we will now expand the court.
And correct me if I'm wrong, in that case, the New York case involving gun rights, we had a few attorneys who prevailed, you know, at least from the point of view of their clients, who then were pressured by their law firms and ended up having to part ways with them. Am I correct in that one?
It's a very interesting thing. Paul Clement, who was a former, I believe, Solicitor General, who was at Kirkland & Ellis, basically Kirkland & Ellis and one of the wags in my office said, yeah, after they collected all the fees from the NRA, told him after that decision came out, choose between the client and the firm. And he did the right thing. And I say right, because when you're a lawyer, you take an oath and your oath is that you will zealously defend the client, even if it's unpopular, even if you've got a bunch of people taking pot shots at you, that doesn't determine whether or not you handle a case or drop a client. And so he parted ways. It was announced last week with Kirkland & Ellis, which is a frontline large, if not one of the largest law firms in the world. But they'd taken the position that they didn't want to be associated with him. This is coming on the heels, by the way, of a lot of the law firms who have jettisoned people who were involved in the Trump election challenges and things like that. It's dangerous territory. I mean, I may vehemently disagree with the politics of some of these things, but The fact remains is that our system is an adversarial system, and you're not supposed to be turning down clients or dropping clients or holding your punches, so to speak, just because they're unpopular. It's a very dangerous situation, I think, but that's for another program. I have one. I think you've got a...
I was just going to tee that up, as a matter of fact. Yeah, Mark.
Before you go, I was watching MSNBC, and they've got a lawyer on there, and presumably he's a lawyer, or advertises himself as a lawyer. I don't know. His name is Ari Melberg, and I think he's got his own show. I don't know if he's ever practiced, but put this up, Gary, because I thought it was interesting.
Someone we all turn to for advice on legal matters, Barbara McQuaid, just posited that there may perhaps be more questions at this hour than answers about whether or not there's any correlation between the committee's decision to move last Wednesday's DOJ day to today and the early morning raid of Jeffrey Clark's, not raid, search of Jeffrey Clark's home. Were there any communications between DOJ and anyone on the committee about the schedule?
I don't know anything about that. And, I'm on the committee that's investigating the attempted overthrow of the 2020 election, not the committee that's investigating us. But I know of no foul play. So I'm not aware of that.
I wasn't suggesting that. There's been a lot of reporting about a lack of shared evidence between the committee and DOJ. And I just wondered if there was any above board coordination or sharing of evidence and any requests from them that you all abided by to move the hearing to give them time to carry out their search.
Absolutely none that I'm aware of. And, we've really been buffeted by the constant infusion of new evidence as new people come forward. And I can tell you, at least for the part that I'm working on with Congresswoman Murphy, there's a lot of new evidence that I'm checking out this weekend.
We didn't get to Ari, but I'll tell you this. This is Jamie Raskin, who is a constitutional scholar. I have a question, Gary, because I often say this, of all the days, 365, unless it's a leap year, days in a year, they would have you believe that the raid, and that's what Nicole Wallace called it before she caught herself, that they had done on Jeffrey Clark, who's a former DOJ lawyer. They had executed a search warrant at his home on the morning of the hearings into the DOJ. Now, Jamie Raskin said, I don't know. That's a coincidence. I want to talk about my new evidence. Well, you're also going to tell me that it's also a coincidence that they moved the congressional DOJ day to the exact day the DOJ executes a search warrant on one of their own.
And no one's sharing any information.
Yeah, but they're not sharing any information. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. If you think that there isn't going to be, if there are indictments that overlap with the January 6th committee, if you don't think that lawyers are going to raise a case called Oliver North, which in Iran-Contra, where this was specifically dealt with and ruled on, then you're smoking something, because clearly there's some kind of connection. There's some kind of communication, could be staff to staff, a la Ron Johnson and Mike Pence, chiefs of staff. But there's something going on. There's no way this is a coincidence that they move the congressional DOJ hearing to the exact morning that they execute a search warrant on a former DOJ lawyer. I just find that outrageous, frankly, and it's theater and it shouldn't have been orchestrated. And frankly, it takes away from the work that the January 6th committee is doing. I mean, I think diminishes their work by making it look like theater.
Yeah, absolutely. My apologies on the Melber clip. A bit of a miscommunication there. That is my fault. But Mark, thank you very much for taking some time for us on a Sunday. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. And thank you, Gary, as always.
As always. All right. Thank you, Mark. Have a good one. And we will see you all later this week for the next edition of Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with Adam Carolla and Mark Garagus. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Stay tuned for more bonus episodes coming soon.